All right, everybody, this is episode number 50. We made it. Halfway to 100. Anyway, I'm probably more excited about that than you are, and I'm almost apologetic. Twice as excited, half as unapologetic. Fractions, ladies and gentlemen, fractions. I got a great show for you lined up, and pretty pumped to bring it to you because I just had a nice conversation with my guests, and I learned a veritable crap ton, and I'm excited, and I hope that you will as well. But before we get to that business, there's some other business to be had. First of all, hey, if you're seeing this on the Nerds United Facebook page, then you are seeing the brand new logo, new artwork, new design. My buddy Joe Dodd coming through like a boss. And I'm so thrilled to have seen, you know, he did all the other monkeys for the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. And I've been doing this show consistently, somewhat consistently, but slightly consistently for the longest. I started in June of 2013. And I tell you what, Kevin Huntsberger, he's catching up over my 1-2-3 cents. If you're a wrestling fan at all, maybe if you just want to relive the memories of Rowdy Roddy Piper or the American Dream Dusty Rhodes, or tell you what, that's a fantastic podcast over there. But he's catching up. But we're really, and the banner carriers, the flag carriers, if you will, we are the ones consistently putting out the podcasts and I guess we're the only ones with enough spare time. But Toby's got three boys, so he's busy. And Matt is back at school, so he's busy. But we occasionally get a pop culture or a gamer out of him and Sierra and Zach. But Toby's just busy. And that's okay, because he's allowed to be busy, because he co-founded this podcast empire with me, and if he doesn't want to put out a show, he doesn't have to put out a show. He gets the same cut of the proceeds as everybody else, and since there are no proceeds, he gets the same cut as everybody else. Speaking of proceeds, if you shop on Amazon, I would appreciate it, or Kevin, one of the two of us. Me, this is my show, but hey, if you go to jitterymonkey.com/nerdsunitedpodcast, scroll down, see that Amazon banner, click that, it'll take you to your regular, everyday Amazon.com. None of the prices are inflated or anything like that. It's just the same great savings and all the fun shipping, but if you do that, hey, I would appreciate it. They are a partner of Nerds United and my 1-2-3 cents, so Do that, support them as they support me and my endeavors. But back to the topic at hand. We were talking about monkeys, and I go to the top dog for my monkey artwork, and that's Joe Dodd. And I said, you know, I've got this Jittery Monkey image with a shield behind him, and you know, the Nerds United up above. I said, I need something new. Can you create for me something new? And he said, well, did you have anything? I said, classic hero pose, cape possibly, domino mask I'd like, because Green Lantern, of course, wears the domino mask. Boom. Done. Phenomenal. Not only that, but he made new words, like the Nerds United part, the word part. And I said, Joe, if I ever open up my comic book shop, can I, which will be called Nerds United, the store, obviously, can I use that logo part, those words, as my sign? And he said, I would be honored, because Joe's a kick-ass stand-up cat like that. So I've been waiting. I said, I'm going to release this with episode 50, and then episode 50 didn't happen quite as early as I would like. So I've been sitting on this for a couple weeks, and it's killing me. But it has been released, so you send Joe Dodd all of the complimentary props that he deserves, because it is top-notch. I'm going to sound a little biased here, but I think it's the best monkey he's ever done, or perhaps will ever do. Thank you, Joe. Thank you so very much. Before we get on to the other business, I mentioned yesterday on Facebook, yesterday being Wednesday, that I have a contest that I'm going to bring up here. But also, it is important to note that I'm going to be starting for the next, I don't know, 50 episodes, something like that. I'm going to be starting a new segment. I think this is going to work. I hope this is going to work. I don't know how this is going to work, but we're going to have, I subscribe, whatever, I'm a member of Loot Crate, if you're a fan of Loot Crate, and in my last bundle, they sent a book, illustrated, but with a lot of good information. It's called The League of Regrettable Superheroes by John Morris. Loot Crate edition. John Morris, a cartoonist and graphic designer since the late 90s. He operated the blog. They had blogs in the late 90s. There you go. Gone and Forgotten, an irreverent, in-depth, and occasionally rude look at the most unfortunate stories and characters that comic books have offered. So, over the course of the next 50 episodes, in this time here, before we get to the meat of it, we will hear the tale of various comic book, forgotten comic book characters, like Justin Wright or Zippo. How about Mother Hubbard? I heard she lived in a cupboard. Brain Boy. The Sentinels. I don't think that's the Sentinels we know. I would bet not. But Adam X, the Extreme. Or this is an odd one. The Super Sons of Batman and Superman. Hey, there are a ton of these in this book, and we're going to hit them all. And who knows, maybe by the end of it, I'll be able to get to John Morris on the show and learn a little bit more about him and why he decided to create such a project. But based on my every other week, give or take, scheduled podcast recording, and that there are, I'd say, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 characters in this book, we'll probably finish up this time in 2017. Yay. You had a long way to go. We won't just go straight through the book. We'll dance around it, hit a few high points, and move on. We're not going to... It'd be foolish of me to sit here and just read verbatim, word for word, everything that each character says. I'll hit a few cliff notes, and we'll move on. But you can bet your bottom dollar that over the course of the next X amount of episodes, regrettable superheroes. Why we should have probably passed on many of them. Now, on to contest time, and then we'll get on to the show. Contest, because you like free stuff, and I like giving you free stuff, and I've got stuff in my house that I've got to get out. We're not going to get into the specifics of why. Let's just say that there's clutter. There's clutter in my house, but it's clutter of value, and I want to give it to one special person. Two special people. It's episode 50. As you know, a while back, my guest, J. Peter Onitz, had sent me the autographed, the first issue autographed of Magicians Must Die, and then 2, 3, and 4 are in their plastic-sealed packs. And so I've got that. That is going to be a fantastic second place prize. First place prize will be the signed, it's like volume one, it's signed of the first volume of Saga. So if you like Saga, or maybe if you don't, maybe if you just like cool signed stuff, that will be the first prize. So I'm sending out two prizes. Two! And all you got to do is pretty simple. There's a movie coming out this weekend, you may have heard. I really want it to be a success. I don't want you to listen to those naysayers online. I don't ever go to Rotten Tomatoes. I don't believe that critics should tell me how to spend my time or money. So I want you to go see the Fantastic Four this weekend. And all you got to do to get entered into the contest is, hey, you're going to go to the theater, or maybe you're going to get your tickets on Fandango. I've done that too, most of the time. But take a picture of the tickets or of the Fandango, screen grab or whatever. Post it as a picture on the Nerds United Facebook page. And everybody who does is going to be entered into the contest. We're giving away two prizes. Again, the signed, autographed Saga Volume 1, and then the autographed first four volumes or issues of Magicians Must Die. So all you got to do, seriously, go watch Fantastic Four. You're probably going to do it anyway. I'm going to go check it out. I don't care. I don't care what the critics say. Early reviews, not great, but I'm standing by what I said months ago, and that's, you know, I'm fully on board. I think it's going to be a kick-ass show, so I'm going to go see Fantastic Four, and I want you to go see it opening weekend as well, and when you do, take a picture of that that ticket stub, or, again, your screenshot of your smartphone from Fandango, and post that as a picture on the Nerds United Facebook page, and you will automatically be entered into the drawing for one of two prizes. So that's all you got to do. It's really just that simple. I like giving stuff away. I like feeling kind of like Santa Claus, except since I've been going to the gym, maybe a leaner, meaner Santa Claus with a Green Lantern tattoo. So that's all I've got for the pre-show. The show is going to be fantastic. You're going to learn a lot. I learned a lot. My guests, one of them is a return, but guest, yeah, he's a repeat guest, and his name is Anthony Mathenia of Stash Publishing, and with him this time around is Seth Ferranti, and Seth is a writer and much more, and they are working together, collaborating with an artist from St. Louis on a project called The Supreme Team. I want you to check that out. Stick around for the end of the show, because there's some Kickstarter information, which you can also get online at jitterymonkey.com/, well, the link for this post. So that's all that I have. The show, the show, the way it's supposed to be, my guest. Shut up, Greg. Okay, my guests are coming up, Anthony and Seth, after the jump. Thank you for tuning in to Nerds United.
Comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Welcome, one and all, episode 50. We have made it halfway to the century mark, which is only slightly more impressive than 49, I guess. I don't know how all that works. Episode 50 of Nerds United on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. I am Greg Mahochko, and I have a loaded show for you on this milestone occasion, if you will, and this is the first time we've ever tried a three-way dance. Three Skype accounts, three different locations, myself and two guests, and we're just going to jump right into it. We're visiting with comic creators and publishers here on Nerds United, and I thank you very much for tuning in. One of the guests, he has been on Nerds United several times because he represents or is associated with or one of the founding members of Stash Publishing. And so welcome back to the show, Anthony Mathenia, sir. And if he's not saying hello, I should probably...
I'm glad to be back. Hey.
I was going to say, because he stepped away to grab a Pepsi of all beverages. But welcome back, sir. How have you been?
I'm good. I'm in North Carolina, and I'm representing the Pepsi because I've come to find out Pepsi is from here.
It's from North Carolina. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. And like everywhere else you go in the world, it's like Coke, Coke, Coke. Everywhere you go in North Carolina, it's Pepsi. And I was wondering about that. I found that out.
Well, you know why, so, though, right? Because Coke is better.
Mexican Coke is good. The Georgia Coke, no thank you. But I will drink the Mexican Coke with the real sugar out of the glass bottles every day of the week. That is good. I will go with you on that one.
Well, see, now you're close enough to my stomping grounds of like Southern Illinois and the Metro East. You've probably tasted the deliciousness that is Ski once or twice.
Yeah.
Okay. That's pure cane sugar right there. I mean, that's, you find a glass bottle Ski, you're living well.
And for listeners all over the world, I assume listeners in Australia, if you don't know what ski is, it's like a citrus type soda.
Yeah, I guess we probably should have prefaced that. But I, on occasion, have enjoyed an ice cold glass bottle ski while recording it and producing it. So hopefully the regular listeners know about the deliciousness that is ski citrus soda. XL
and
bottling.
They have a bottling tour. Where is it? Lebanon?
Breeze. Breeze, Illinois.
Illinois. Yeah, right. You can go see them bottle ski.
It's like
this episode of Nerd United brought to you by ski. Thank
you. It's like going on the Anheuser-Busch brewery tour, except no brew. Actually, I take that back. XL Bottling does do some beers now, in case you wanted Carlisle Lake Lager. And nobody wants Carlisle Lake Lager. I apologize. So welcome back, Anthony. And really, the feature guest for episode 50 is a writer, and his name is Seth Ferranti. Seth, welcome to the show, sir, and honor to have you on Nerds United.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
We have talked with Anthony in the past, and we've heard his origin story, so we're just going to kind of jump right in. You are working on and have a Kickstarter project going on, Kickstarter campaign, I should say, going on right now through your work with Stash Publishing on a graphic novel called Supreme Team, but it's actually a graphic novel based on a nonfiction book that you put out. When did you put out Supreme Team, sir?
The Supreme Team was published in 2010.
So it's had a little shelf life, and now it's definitely one of those. And as we get into the meat or the nuts and bolts of it, we're going to find that it's a story that translates very well to the pages of a graphic novel. But tell me just a little bit, the bacon. I'm trying to think, just the frosting. I don't know, whatever you want to call it, but tell me just a little bit of Supreme Team before we retcon and get your story.
All right, what Supreme Team is the Supreme Team was a crack dealing organization from the mid-80s of Queens, New York. And kind of, if you look at the history of the crack era, crack and hip-hop were kind of born at the same time. You know, their genesis goes all the way, you know, back to New York in the mid-80s, and Queens was almost like ground zero. And the Supreme Team was actually a group of five percenters called the Peace Gods, and they metamorphosized into the Supreme Team. And their namesake and founder was a guy named Kenneth Supreme McGriff. And I was locked up, and while I was locked up, he actually became a real good friend of mine. And that's why I got interested in writing them, and I did the book, and now we're bringing the graphic novel.
So let's, you said right there, locked up. But before we get even to that, let's go back to the beginning. Hey, this being, you know, this graphic novel being your first foray, by my understanding, into comic books. But have you always been a fan of comics and you know, wanting to get your hands on the colorful pages?
Oh, I love comics. I started out when I was a kid. I used to read like Secret Wars was one of my favorites. And then I love Doctor Doom. I've always been more like a Marvel guy. I like some DC, like I like the Joker and Batman, but I've always been a big Marvel guy. I was way into the Secret Wars, you know, the Hulk, Spider-Man, and that whole concept of them being put on a world and battling each other to see who was the strongest, you know, the villains and the heroes. And that was when I was a real young kid, when the Secret Wars was going on. And then after that, like I'd say about the mid-80s, I really got into the X-Men. I became a huge X-Men fan. I read, you know, because the X-Men had all the spinoff titles, and there was probably 10 or 12 spinoff titles with New Mutants, Wolverine, X-Factor, X-Force, and I had subscriptions to all of them, and I was reading them all. I remember when I was like probably 12, 13, 14, 15, I couldn't wait until my subscriptions for the different X-Men, Wolverine included, the comics would come in every month, just like Nightcrawler, Colossus, Storm, Cyclops. You know, I was really big. I was a diehard X-Men fan, I would say.
Since you brought up your love of X-Men, I've got to ask you, completely off the topic of you, but I know you've read the story arc Days of Future Past.
Oh, yeah, I've read it.
and I only picked it up within the last year or so, but they make the movie last year. What did you think of the movie?
I mean, I don't really think any of the movies. I look at the movies, it's a different thing, because I know the movie has to follow a certain formula, you know, in certain story arcs, and have a firm beginning, middle, and end. So it's never going to be exactly like the comics. And I remember in the mid-80s when I was reading X-Men and all stuff like that and all the comics I was reading, I wish they would make movies, because I was thinking, man, this stuff would make awesome movies. And then, you know, 20 years later, that's all we get now is superhero movies. I mean, I can believe they're trying, but, I mean, it's a big budget. It has a lot of hands in it. It's being, you know, pulled a whole bunch of different ways. You know, they have script writers coming in writing off the comics. So, I mean, it is what it is. I enjoy going to see them, but, you know, I've yet to see one, any superhero movie that matches up exactly to the original comic. But I take it for what it is. It's entertainment. It's characters that I know and love. So, I mean, I enjoy them.
Anthony, while we're on the topic, your opportunity to weigh in here, has there, what would you say is the closest from original, you know, to the movie adaptation of the movies that they've made that you've seen?
I'm really not qualified to talk about this, but I will say this. I like the X-Men movie that had January Jones from Mad Men. And she played...
First Class, Emma Frost.
Yeah, Emma Frost. I like the 60s style. So that was good. And then, and what was the sequel? Days of Future Past?
Mm-hmm.
I really like Tyrion in that movie.
And, Peter Dinklage. And then Age of Apocalypse, or X-Men Apocalypse, when it comes out next year, set in the 80s, which sounds like we're all, you know, kind of... the formative years were in the 80s. Any excitement and... And Seth, I promise we're coming back to you, but
I'm good. Let's go.
But any excitement to relive those awkward 80s years?
Well, the Supreme Team graphic novel is all about the 80s.
Look at this guy bringing it back.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's early 80s, Queens, New York, at the birth of like rap music. And as... yeah, my experience in the 80s was very much defined by that a little bit. What's kind of been interesting for me is going back and listening to this older hip-hop music and discovering, like, as a kid, I didn't even realize, like, all the Seth talked about earlier about the five percenters, where the Supreme Team came from, which was kind of like a religious theological movement. Their teachings would be in the rap music that I would be, like, rapping along to. So just, like, when I'm reading the Supreme Team and Seth's bringing that back, it's kind of like a really cool flashback to at least my 1980s.
Kind of comes full circle a little bit on you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really cool to revisit that. But the 1980s in general, not really a huge 80s guy. I really like that mid-century 60s stuff. Mad Men all the way.
Mad Men all the way. So you shed a tear earlier this year when the series ended.
Oh, I shed many tears on that series. I'm in the middle of a binge watch right now, and I'm just like, man, this is so good. How do I make something like this into a comic book someday? I mean, with this depth.
Back, Seth, you're going to learn very early on, if you haven't learned already. I like to jump around a lot. I suffer from recording ADD or something like that, so I bounce. But you're please don't take this I don't want to say the wrong way, but your accent kind of keys to me that you're maybe from out east a little bit.
Well, I'm originally from California.
Okay, well then I'm way off.
No, but I spent 21 years in prison on the East Coast with guys from New York, with guys from Boston, with guys from Philly and Jersey and DC. So I do have an East Coast accent. That's what a lot of people think. I'm maybe from New Jersey or New York, but they can't really pin it down. But really, I tell people, I got a prison accent. I was East Coast prison with all East Coast guys, so that's where I got a prison accent. I was in prison on the East Coast, so that's how I see it.
If you don't mind, you know, exploring that a little bit or discussing a little bit more about that, what landed you in prison? Tell me a little bit about, as you got older, you know, comics, you know, went with you a little bit and in reading what I could, you know, what certainly what Anthony provided as far as nice materials for me, but you got a ton of comics that you were reading in prison. But what steps or, you know, how did your life go on that you ended up there, sir?
Well, I was reading comics. You know, like I said, I was into X-Men, and I started getting into psychedelics a lot, probably around the age of like 15 and 16, and smoking a lot of weed. And I know with a lot of people, you know, psychedelics and weed and comics, it all kind of goes together. But I took it a step further than, you know, the normal suburban type of guy, because I started selling it. And it wasn't it. I just kind of started selling to support my own habit, you know, and hook up my friends, because I was originally from California and I had some connections in California that could send it out to the East Coast. Because actually I went to high school in Virginia, like junior and senior year. And that's why I caught my case in Virginia. So it just turned into this thing over about 3 years, from the age of 16 to 19, where I was just selling to my high school buddies. And then by the time I'm 19, as everybody went off to colleges on the East Coast, I was supplying 15 colleges in 5 states with LSD and marijuana.
I didn't want to interrupt. I didn't know if you were going more there. I mean, you say the case in Virginia, if that doesn't happen in Virginia, let's say it happens in California, I mean, your life might be completely different as far as the people, the individuals that you met and the friends that you made inside. We might not be having this conversation if you didn't, I guess, as awkward as it is to say, the stars didn't align in the way that they did.
Yeah, I would say, too, if I got busted in California, I would have received a lot less time, because Virginia, even for the Fed cases, Virginia is known. Like when I got busted, they were saying like I was East Coast drug kingpin. But you know, I got busted with like 10,000 hits of acid, which is basically like 100 sheets. In California, that 100 sheets of acid is like a drop in the bucket, because 100 sheets of acid is like a gram of crystal LSD. In California, they're doing like 25 gram busts of crystal LSD. It's so prevalent. But in Virginia, that was a real big case, and they pushed it federal. And then everybody started cooperating, and then all of a sudden I was a kingpin.
What's going through your mind? I mean, at the time when, you know, maybe for, again, based on the location of it, if it's in California, it's perhaps, I don't want to say minor, but it's, you know, not federal, but now based in Virginia, and they're able to really, really come down hard on you. What was going through your mind at that time?
I mean, I'll be honest with you. I felt real persecuted, because I was a college drug dealer. I mean, for my age, for a 19-year-old, I was doing okay. I was making like $20,000-$30,000 a month. But in the big scheme of things, I was a small drug dealer. I didn't have a criminal organization. I didn't carry a gun. In fact, I was a first-time nonviolent offender. And when I got that time, really, and I first went to prison, I got 304 months when I was 22. And I'll be honest, I was in shock. I would say my first 9 years in prison, I used to smoke a lot of weed. In my first 9 years in prison, I probably stayed stoned every day just to try to, you know, deaden the shock that I was in. You know, it really took me 9 years in prison to kind of get a grip, you know, and start doing something positive for my future and become the man that I was in. The first 9 years, you know, I was real reckless. I don't want to say suicidal, but I was more reckless. I didn't care about myself. I didn't care about my life. I felt, you know, 25 years to me at that time was like a life sentence. You know, I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. So I did some really stupid stuff, you know, and I was real bad on drugs and I was real reckless. And I mean, really, I'm happy to say that I made it through that 9 years, you know, like unscathed, you know, and didn't get killed or shanked or whatever, because it easily could have happened with the situations I was putting myself in.
And like you said, not suicidal, but not in the best way, perhaps, because of the decisions that you were making inside. And like you said, 25-year sentence when you're only 19, 20 years old. I mean, that's, you know, that's another – you hadn't lived 25 years to know how long 25 years could be. So I certainly understand the toll that it can take emotionally or mentally, and, you know, could put an individual in that kind of – I don't care type of mentality, where maybe you're not as cautious you know, with your body or with your decisions as you would be otherwise.
Oh, yeah. It was crazy. I mean, I look back now, but for real, I thank God that my life didn't take another course, because I could easily – I put myself in tons of situations where I could have something happen to me, or I might have had to do something real drastic to somebody, and we might not even be having this conversation now, because I could be dead or I could be serving a life sentence.
So after that 9 years, was there a certain event at that point or an altercation or an incident that kind of brought the clarity to you, or was it something that happened, you know, from year nine? You know, did it take a little while, or was there just that one, you know, snap of the fingers that's like, oh man, I've got to do something different if I'm going to survive?
Yeah, I would just say I grew up. I mean, one big step I did was I stopped doing drugs. You know, I stopped living that lifestyle, because people might think you go in prison, you know, drugs aren't available or whatever, but drugs are available. You can get heroin, marijuana. People are bringing it in. They're doing all types of stuff. It's just like the real world, except it's like on a lot smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
So I stopped doing drugs. I stopped being around those type of people. And I started doing positive stuff. I took some college classes up to that point, like off and on, but my parents were really after me. They're like, you know, while you're in there, why don't you take this time, get your college education, do something positive with your life. And so my parents, you know, they had the offer out, and I started taking correspondence courses, and I earned an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, and a master's degree.
Excellent.
You know, and I started really getting serious at that 9-year point. And then since I was in prison and I was taking correspondence courses, you can only really go two routes. You can go like a business type of degree, or you can go like a liberal arts type of degree. And I chose the liberal arts, and I was doing a lot of writing, like creative writing, article writing, you know, writing on literature, any type. I was taking like all literature and heavy writing courses for a liberal arts type of degree. And so that's when I really kind of found – I already like to read, and I like comics, and I always played in bands. I used to sing and play guitar in bands when I was growing up. And I used to kind of dabble in poetry, you know, when I was a teenager. I thought I was like maybe like a Jim Morrison type of dude. But really, when I started taking those college classes, I really found that I really loved to write, and I was pretty good at it. So I spent, you know, the rest of my time in honing my craft and building up. You know, I published 7 books while I was in. So I started publishing books and articles, and I just started writing all my ideas down. So when I did eventually get out, I could start implementing and finding the people to help me bring all my ideas to fruition.
I was going to ask, and you kind of answered the question for me, but talking about doing all that writing, were you doing any writing, you know, journal or anything like that in the first 9 years? You know, kind of keep track of your thoughts, and then maybe now looking back, able to compare the early writing from the early part of your sentence to later stuff, and just to see how you changed or how you matured?
I would say, you know, I was still playing in bands in prison, so the first 9 years, it was more like lyric poetry type stuff.
Okay.
You know, as opposed, you know, to actual, you know, nonfiction writing.
At what point, I'm sorry, that this is, folks, I'll tell you, this is the downside of not recording, you know, face-to-face, is I can't see when they're done talking, so sometimes I accidentally talk over them. I apologize, Seth. At what point did you, you know, start to hang out, become friends with, you know, the folks that you're writing about, as far as a Supreme Team and learning more about that? Because I know that one of the works that you published was, you know, that gangster hip hop type of nonfiction book. Not, you know, that I don't want to say. Biography, but you know, kind of a little bit of that explanation of that period and that time. At what point in the sentence did you start to befriend Supreme?
Well, I was always a good athlete too. So even when I first went in, you know, I love sports. So even my first 9 years, when I was doing lots of drugs and I was kind of reckless, I was actively participating in sports. And when you play sports in prison, and especially when you play basketball in prison, as a white guy, sometimes I would be like one of the only white guys on the court. So I was already getting to know a bunch of these dudes even before I had ideas about writing books. And really, it's kind of funny how things work out, because my reputation from that first 9 years, you know, I kind of had a reputation as a go-hard white boy in prison. So I got a lot of respect, you know, not only from my own people, but from the other races, because they knew if anything involved white dudes, I would usually be the one at the forefront trying to straighten it out or handle it, you know, doing the diplomatic actions or whatever I had to do to kind of dead or crush the situation. So I already had a pretty high respect level. And then I was out there. I knew a lot of them. I had relationships with them because I was playing basketball and other sports. So it was kind of really in prison. I mean, it's a lot of racial stuff, but if you're like a like dudes will say, like, he's a solid dude or he's a respected con. And if you're that type of dude and you want to talk to other dudes like that, it doesn't matter if they're black or Mexican or whatever. There's kind of like an understanding or a familiarity, because you're like, okay, you're a solid dude. I'm a solid dude. We're both doing a lot of time. We got something in common, even though a lot of the stuff about us is different.
Like, you used the word diplomat or diplomatic. The word that came to mind was ambassador. I don't know if they were laughing at me or not, but
maybe.
It's just the timing of that was perfect, but ambassador from the standpoint of, you know, like you said, going out, you know, you use the example of, you know, if a white guy was involved, you were there smoothing, you know, calming the water, so to speak. That was the word that came to my mind.
Yeah, so I had a lot of relations with all the different ethnic groups, with all the different gangs and gang leaders and stuff like that. So really, when I started writing, I started making overtures to write, you know, and express my ideas and talk to these dudes and get their stories. I already had like not like I was the baddest dude in the compound or had the highest respect level, or, you know, I was like the head shot caller or anything like that, but I already had a level of respect. These dudes respected me on a prison level. So when I brought them these ideas and I said, look, this is what I want to do, it's not like I'm just some dude. You know, they already knew who I was and I already had a reputation and I was accepted in the hierarchy of the prison environment.
So at what point did you, you know, kind of start hanging around and I don't want to say learning the ways, but learning the history and hearing the stories of the 80s and the dawning of hip hop and the crack and when did that take place?
Well, I would say it started in the mid 90s, because I mean, just like Anthony, I grew up on rap music. You know, rap music started at the same time when I was like a teenager. You know, not to say, I mean, I like metal music and punk rock too, but that was probably my three things. I like metal, punk, and rap. So even in prison, I'm playing basketball and I'm familiar with a lot of the guys. So even though they, because in prison they got like, you got like a white TV, a black TV, Mexican TV. But since I knew a lot of the dudes, they would be watching like MTV Yo Raps and stuff like that when all the gangster rap was in vogue in the mid 90s. And I could actually go in there, in their TV rooms, and hang out and listen, and they accepted me because I used to play basketball with them. So that's when really the genesis of, you know, all the ideas, when I put my first book out in 2005, that's when it first started forming, when I started hearing the stories in the mid-90s. You know, I'm hearing the stories, and they're rapping like Nas and Jay-Z and Biggie and these other guys. They're rapping about the guys, and then, you know, eventually in the later 90s, 50 Cent and these dudes are like, right, you know, they might be in the next block over. They're on the compound. And I was real curious. I was like, man, who are these guys? And they'd be like, the guys would just tell me all the different stories, like from the street legends. And I became real intrigued. So then I would go pay my respects to the guys like Supreme or whoever else it was. And I would talk to them, you know, just becoming familiar with them even before I approached them, you know, about doing a book or stuff like that.
Did any of these individuals that you were talking to, did any of them show any apprehension to, you know, to talking with you or based on the credibility and the respect that you had gained and earned, it did they kind of, you know, hear about you ahead of time?
I would say a lot of these dudes were apprehensive. I've had dudes tell me straight out that they didn't want to do stories. I had a lot of other dudes that I wanted to write about, and I always leave it like this. I can approach somebody, I can talk to them, I can tell them my ideas, even on the outside. But if somebody doesn't want to do anything, then I don't pursue it. I mean, there's a bunch of other stories to pursue. It's not like I have to do this story, I have to do that story.
Right.
I try to collaborate and work with different people. It's just like out here, you form relationships with different people. Sometimes you might vibe with them and you might work together and you might do something. Sometimes the relationship might fall off, so then you might stop doing what you're doing. I've always been that type of person where I'm not going to just exploit a situation or a person, you know, just because that's what I want to do. You know, if it's something we can find some common ground and we can come to things. I tell dudes this every day, all the time. I was writing stories about guys in the penitentiary when I was in the penitentiary. So you know how, like, writers on the street, they always have things like celebrities or NBA players or people come out and they say, oh, I was misquoted, that's not what I said, and stuff like that. I mean, you hear it all the time, right?
Right, right.
Well, in prison, I couldn't afford that, because if somebody says I misquoted them, they're going to come stab me in the back. So what I used to do, I used to interview them, I used to write the stuff up, and then I used to bring it to them and let them read it.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I've done this with almost all my work and all my books. And sometimes I would have to change drastically what I wrote, because the people, they'd be like, oh, I don't like how this looks. Or they might let their homeboy read it, and their homeboy would say, oh, you can't do that. You know, because it's all about image and reputation with these guys. So I went through a lot of stuff like that. But I do it, like, even today to a certain extent. You know, when I write something about people, I'm real aware, you know, of how it's going to impact them, of how it's going to impact their family, of how it's going to make them look. So I'm not trying to exploit anybody just for a story. I like to tell stories. And I like to get the news out there about what's going on, but I'm not doing it. If somebody really comes to me and they go, look, man, I don't think you should do this, or I don't feel comfortable, then I'm going to be like, okay, and I'm just going to drop it.
Hearing you say that, I mean, I certainly understand where you're coming from, but it's completely different. I mean, I follow quite a few athletes or you know, athletic programs, things like that, who maybe they're misquoted, you know, by a newspaper journalist or something like that. And, you know, that might lead to a burning of a bridge. But like you said, if you're inside and something is miscommunicated or misconstrued, that's a very potentially lethal or fatal burning of a bridge right there. So I definitely see where you're coming from as far as how you had to, I don't know, tiptoe that line or tread very carefully.
Yeah, it's you gotta be assertive, but it's almost like a polite assertiveness. You know, because in prison you can't let anybody walk over you, but at the same time, if I'm telling somebody's story, I want them to be comfortable with it, because I don't want any repercussions. I don't want anything, you know, to go on down the line. Like even the comic book we're doing. Like when I first got the artwork drawn up, and me and Anthony got some little postcards and we got a cover made. I sent the little flyer into Supreme, you know, and he called me and he told me, he was like, who's that guy sitting in the chair supposed to be, you know? And I was like, that's you, man. What are you talking about? And he was like, nah, man, that ain't me. That ain't me. But I mean, I know him. That's the type of relationship, you know. Supreme's like the type of dude. He doesn't say a lot, but what he does say holds a lot of weight, and he's real cautious. I mean, he has a life sentence now, so he has to be real careful. But, you know, he knows my ultimate goal. You know, I'm trying to get a movie made about him eventually. You know, I'm doing the comic, but eventually I want to get a movie. And he trusts that I have his best interest at heart, you know, because I've done articles about him. I've done books. Now I'm doing this comic. And pretty much, you know, he trusts me. You know, and he knows what my end goal and my end result is. And as long as I do it the right way, you know, and as long as I don't make him look any type of funny way or whatever, he's cool with what I'm doing.
And like you said, having that end goal, the trust factor being what it is, it certainly seems to me like you said, that you have, you know, his best interests in mind, you know, maybe to I don't know if it's as a cautionary tale or just his side of the story, but to get his, you know, the story told from his viewpoint, I would imagine would be very, very critical to him and, you know, vis-a-vis to you as well. So, I definitely see, the importance of, in other forms of media would be called journalistic integrity, but in your case, we'll just call it accuracy, I guess. So, I want to talk, you mentioned 2010 was when Supreme Team, the book, was published, correct?
Yes.
And how many, Seth, how many books did you publish when you were inside? I know you mentioned books, but I didn't catch the number.
Seven books.
So, over, I mean, there are people who, I'll just say it, who are not in prison, or were not in prison, who, you know, maybe have the drive, but or maybe have the end game, but don't have the drive to get, you know, that type of press or publication, and you just, you know, you sat there and you just busted your ass to get these done. How were these publications, how were they received to, you know, just, I don't know, the consumers or the critics or whomever?
Well, my biggest market is prison. In prison, and especially like the guys in the penitentiaries and in the high security prisons, they're the ones, they love my books, you know, and they almost take my book like it's the Bible, you know. That's why I try to, you know, I've heard of like dudes falling out and beasts happening and different situations happening because of what's written in my book. That's why my book, so I try to make sure I check with different sources, you know, in court records and newspaper articles and then the people themselves. So I try to, you know, like you said, I write a cautionary tale, but at the same time, you know, I do. I glorify and I romanticize this stuff because to me, there's a certain mythical nature to these guys, just like Robin Hood, just like Billy the Kid, just like Bonnie and Clyde, Pablo Escobar, John Gotti, Lucky Luciano. To me, these guys from the crack era and the guys in the Supreme Team that I wrote the book about and now I'm doing the comic about, they got that same aura about them. So I try to tell the story and show what happens, but at the same time, I try to maintain that aura that has enveloped around them, you know, through the rap songs and through the magazines and through the hood legend and street legend and stuff like that. I try to maintain that legend and that mythology because to me, that's like Billy the Kid and Jesse James. That's what attracts people. That's what people like. People like those larger than life people, especially of the outlaw variety.
And what year did you get out then, Seth?
I got out in February.
Oh, just 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that leads to perfectly, better than I could have imagined, to my next question, which is how did you and Anthony cross paths? How did you guys meet, and how did you guys get hooked up?
I had an acquaintance.
Let Anthony tell it.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I had an acquaintance who was in a halfway house at the same time that Seth was in a halfway house, and he had brought me some postcards and stuff from Seth, and he knew I was into writing, and was like, "Yeah, check out this guy. I met him. He seemed really cool. He's doing these crime books," and he gave me like some of Seth's postcards. And so I emailed Seth, and Seth sent me some of his books, and I got to read. And well, actually, I think the first one I read was Supreme Team, the Supreme Team, a nonfiction book. And I'm reading it, and I'm like, man, this is exciting stuff. And I start thinking, because I'm a, you know, a comic book guy, it's like, wow, this would look really cool. And so I talked to Seth. I said, have you ever thought about doing comics? And he's like, yeah, I have. I just, you know, was locked up and it wasn't really all that possible. So we just started talking about, you know, what we could do. And yeah, this comic book came out of it.
And being, you know, exactly what you said there, Anthony, about being locked up and not having the access to create a comic book inside Seth brings me back to, you know, a great talking point that was made out in the press release or in the Kickstarter video, one of those two, about just the limited access to quality paper. So tell me about that, you know, because not just the paper, but all the artists, all the really great artists, they're doing something else in prison, aren't they?
Yeah, they're all doing tattoos. And look, you do not know, I wanted to do comics forever while I was inside. I had all different types of ideas, even before I started writing these books, you know, since like around 99. And I had different little things I wrote here and there. And I was always go to the dudes, and we would try to figure out a way to do it. I even got, I'm sure you guys have seen them. They have like these big, like these Marvel books, you know, like how to do comics, how to draw comics, how to create comics. And I would order all these books and I would read them. And I kept going to the artists and I'd be like, man, let's do this. This is what we need. This is what we need. And they're like, oh, well, we can't get this paper. Well, we can get like the pencils and the inks, but we can't get anything to color. And then, you know, then how are we going to get it? You know, then like nowadays it's Photoshop this and Photoshop that. And every time I kept trying to do stuff, I just kept running into roadblocks. And even like the dudes, like I had some dudes that might be interested, but instead of drawing that, they'd be like, well, I got to go make money. And I'll be like, well, what do you mean? We can make money off this if we do it, if you put the time and effort. Then we're like, look, all right, I got to go get money right now. Dude wants to pay me $100 for a tattoo.
Right.
You know, so they would go and do that. And all the good artists, they were so consumed with making that money, like right in the moment. You know, I was thinking long term because I knew even if we came up with everything for a comic, you know, even like what me and Anthony now, we're still thinking long term. We're trying to build a brand. We're trying to build a series. You know, I want to make this into a series and have several graphic novels out. So we're thinking long term. But in prison, really, everybody's thinking short term. Everybody's thinking in the minute. In the minute, that's really like the criminal mentality. The criminal mentality, you don't think long term. It's just instant gratification. Like, what can I get for myself right now?
Is that, and I don't, I'll try to tiptoe a little bit around this myself, but is that because for whatever reason you don't know if you're going to be there tomorrow? I mean, I don't understand really that mentality, so I apologize if I'm coming off ignorant, but...
No, I think it's like a little kid mentality. You know, you know like how little kids, they'll kick or scream or do whatever for they want, and they don't care how it affects their mom or dad, or all they want, if they want that ice cream or if they want that toy, they want it right then. And a lot of guys that are criminals, and even me for a long time, it was like you just never grow up because you're out there committing crimes. You don't care who it affects. You don't care how it affects your loved ones. You don't care how it affects your kids. You don't care how it affects your spouse. You're going to do what you want to do when you want to do it. And, you know, who cares about the rest of the world? That's just the attitude. And really, I mean, when I was younger, I didn't see it like that. But now, you know, as a 44-year-old man, and as I've grown in responsibility and I've become more aware in life, I look back now and I see that's exactly what it is. I mean, when you don't care about anybody but yourself and really you're putting yourself in all these dangerous situations so you don't even care about yourself, it's just a real little kid mentality.
Anthony, you mentioned a moment ago about how when you were looking at the Supreme Team that kind of had that realization, that you know, aha moment, the little light bulb going over your head and say, this could make a really kick-ass graphic novel. What did you see in that? Was it just the topic or the way that it was portrayed or written out? I mean, obviously you saw something in Seth's writing that made you, you know, want to reach out and say you want to do comics, or maybe at the time you didn't even know you wanted to do comics, but you've got a story to tell. I've got another outlet to tell your story in a more visual medium. Hi, my name is Anthony. Let's make a graphic novel together.
There's a lot of different reasons why this particular thing clicked for me. One of the things is I think American comics have a lot of growing up and a lot of diversification to do. And I'm saying that with the knowledge of like all the independent stuff that's out there through like an Image and a Dark Horse. But ever since the 1950s when the Comic Code came in and killed like every genre, including crime, romance, horror, etc., the only thing that survived was the superhero. And Walking Dead brought back horror a little bit. Brubaker and Phillips, they brought back crime a little bit. But we're behind. We're stunted. We're not like the Europeans and Chinese in the terms of the diversification and storytelling. So when I look at a book like Supreme Team, where it's got that pulp vein of that true crime 1950s, but this one's set in the 80s, and instead of telling the story of like prohibition gangsters and that, you know, in the underbelly of like a 1940s or 1950s New York, you know, we're telling the modern story, or this, you know, of the era of the 80s with the gangsters of the day, which were the crack dealers. So it paid, as I read that story, it paid respects to the past, but it felt like an update to that in a way to like push things forward. The other thing that appealed to me about the story was just like you talked about with the romanticizing of the, you know, the Billy and the Billy the Kid and Robin Hood, just this over the top mythology that develops around these larger than life characters. And you know, guys like Supreme, they cast a big shadow. And over the decade, the influence to hip hop music, I'm a big, huge fan of Fantagraphics Hip Hop Family Tree. And I love hearing stories about how hip hop came to be. And so when I read Supreme Team and get this other angle, which I never knew about, I didn't know how the YMCA village people type early hip hop morphed into this more harder street edge, you know, rap music. And Supreme Team and others in that area, that's the link.
I'm not going to lie. That might be the first time I ever heard YMCA type village people and hip hop in the same sentence ever.
Well, when you look at like when hip hop came out, it came out of the disco era. And so the people that were doing it, you know, they had the costumes and kind of the pageantry of the disco funk type era. You know, and there's a huge step from that to like a Run-DMC, where we're going to, you know, the leather jackets and the hats and the gold jewelry and stuff like that, exactly. And you know, as like reading like in Seth's book, you see the evolution of this and how these guys were basically emulating, you know, the people that they saw successful when they were coming up, which happened to be these street gangsters.
So tell me, and either one of you can field this question, but how did the process start from taking this from a book and transferring it, or transforming it, I should say, into a graphic novel? Walk me through those steps or how that process began.
Well, what Anthony did, because he already had some comic scripts, I was a little familiar with writing scripts because I had read some books on it. I hadn't actually written any comic scripts, but I had written some screenplays and stuff like that. So I was a little familiar with the format, but he had sent me some of his own work and some of the stuff that Stash published. And I looked at that, and then he sent me the actual original scripts so I could look and see how it translated into a comic book. But then I could go back and look at the script, which is actually the blueprint, you know, that he or the other guys from Stash put together. So he sent me all this material, and I started studying and I started looking at it. And then I came up with like a basic little outline, and I sent it to him and said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Go ahead, write it out." So I wrote it out and I sent it to him, and he was like, "Okay, this is good. This is bad. We need to change this. I need to edit here. I need to reformat this." And kind of, it was like a back and forth process, and really he taught me how to write a comic script. I over that first script, I learned from him, and I'm still learning from him to this day. Like I've told plenty of people, this is something I wanted to do. Everybody always told me that my work, the journalism I'm doing and the nonfiction stuff I'm doing, a bunch of people have told me that it would translate real good to comics. I've been hearing this since I was in. But to actually find a person like Anthony who can take me through all the steps, I mean, I don't know if I was just with anybody if I would have been able to do it this easily or translate, because he really walked me through and has guided me. And I mean, plus it's the fact, I guess, you know, certain people you just click with, man, in business or in life. And me and Anthony, you know, we click on a lot of different levels on certain things. And I feel real comfortable, you know, because for me, my writing, that's like my passion. It's almost like my baby. And to actually let somebody else, you know, have some say or, you know, change stuff, you know, I got to really trust them and respect them on a certain level, or I wouldn't even listen to them. And, you know, with me and him, we just really vibe good, and I work real good with him. And I'm actually extremely pleased that I got lucky enough to meet him through his friend Steve and to bring this whole project about.
Yeah, Anthony's a pretty good babysitter.
Yeah.
the thing about guys like Seth is, like, they're already good storytellers, even though, like, Seth had worked in the past in nonfiction true crime. It's still telling stories. And he's a really good storyteller. The only thing is teaching people how to adapt their storytelling ability to the comic format, which is a 24-page issue or chapter, and making sure all the action hits at the right spots. It's more technical. I mean, they already know how to tell stories. It's just, it's all the technical things. And one of the things that through Seth that I've been able to do is to reach out to other really great storytellers that have worked in other genres, be it, you know, street literature or urban fiction or gangster nonfiction, and to like work with them as well as to adapt their stories to comics. And I think at the end of the day, I hope that's going to be a good thing for not just for us and what we're doing, but for comics in general, because, you know, I guess as cool as it is to go in a new comic book day and see a shelf full of like
capes and cowls, just say capes and cowls.
I'm gonna limit it to the five separate Batman titles that came out that week. You know, that's cool, and that's great if you're a Batman fan, but I think comics can tell a lot of different stories. With this, we're doing a street comic that's influenced by true events, but, you know, that's just the start. I just really want to push and see what kind of different stories we can tell via comics. That's my passion.
And I think, you know, not just this direction, but like you said before, you know, there's superheroes are overwhelmingly dominant on the new shelf rack. You know, you got the Walking Deads and some things like that, but there's definitely an audience for this type of story, for something that's a little bit more real. And speaking of real, you can't do something, you know, a project like this unless the art is on point. So tell me a little bit about the artist that was selected or approached, and the guy who's doing a phenomenal job on what I've seen of early work of Supreme Team. And tell me a little bit about the artist. I'm pumped to know all about him.
All right. Well, the artist is Joe Wills, and I mean, Joe is phenomenal. I mean, the dude is amazing. I would put his art up, the art that he's drawn for this book, I would put it up against anything that Marvel or DC has to offer, just for quality-wise. I mean, you know, I'm proud of my story, too. I would put my story up. But just if you just take the art, you can put it with any top-quality Marvel or DC artist, and he's right there with these guys, if not better than some of them. And I'd say just how we found him was, you know, when I first got out, I've been talking to Anthony probably since around October, November, when I was in the halfway house, you know, which I was out, but I was like halfway out. It's like a work release from August until February. So me and Anthony started formulating our plan, and then we're like, we got to find an artist. So we started looking for artists. We were looking for some online, you know, after I finished the script. And he was going to the Comic-Con, so he suggested, he's like, man, start coming to the Comic-Cons. He goes, you can meet people, you can network. We can show people your script. We can talk about our idea and just meet people in the industry. So I took his advice, and I went to the Comic-Con in Kansas City, and it was actually another stash guy, Jordan Williams, Anthony's partner, and he knew we were looking for artists, and he said, look, there's this St. Louis guy. He's here. His name is Joe Wills. He's phenomenal. He even told me, he's like, look, you got to talk to this dude now, because in 2 or 3 years, he'll probably be drawn for Marvel and DC once he gets some stuff out and they see his work. So Jordan took me right to Joe Wills, and I talked to him, and I sent him the script, and I told him my ideas. And really, at first, I wasn't really sure if he was with you know, what I was trying to do. You know, I even gave him a Scream Team book. So I wasn't sure if he was with it. I mean, because he seemed interested, but he didn't seem like he was all in. But, you know, we finally, me and Anthony talking to him and going back and forth, we got him to start doing some sketches and to start drawing some stuff. And once we saw what he was producing, I was like, man, we got to have this guy, you know? So we just kept on him. And then he finally committed to us and he said, look, I'm going to do it. And he started drawing, you know, the pages for the Kickstarter. Now, you know, he's drawing the rest of the book. And I'm just extremely pleased that we found him because his stuff is really phenomenal, man. It's like first class.
And like you said, you know, in a couple of years, he might be unavailable for a project like this.
The thing about Joe is that he was always drawing like superheroes, and kind of his apprehension with jumping into Supreme Team is like, could he adapt his more traditional superhero style to a true crime type book? So he was doing some original sketches and stuff, going back and looking at books from the era, even getting down to like making sure the graffiti was correct for the era. And when he started showing these like pages, it was amazing. There was no other guy that I know of that could do this book but him. And what he's bringing to it, it blows me away every time I get a new page in the email. It floors me every time.
It's one of those, and I've listened to enough, you know, other podcasts I've talked with enough artists and writers. What is the kind of format? Because I know some writers like to give a very detailed, you know, script to the artist, and some, I don't want to say that they trust their artist more, but you know, they have kind of inside their brains, they'd been working together for so long. What kind of information are you relaying to Joe to kind of give him the vision or the viewpoint that you're after, panel to panel or page to page? Is there a lot of detail that you're putting in, or is it more, you know, just kind of a framework and allowing him that artistic license, if you will?
Well, I would tell you, I'm a concept dude. I'm real good like coming up with concepts and come with stories and making stuff flow and grinding it out. But the stuff we give Joe is extremely detailed, but it's extremely detailed because of Anthony. Because in this relationship, I'm like the concept. I'm the story dude. I'm the one who's going to grind it out. But Anthony is a detail guy. Anthony is a guy that takes my raw content, my raw concept, my raw story. You know, like I did plenty of stuff where I would put stuff and he'd be like, nah, we got to divide this up in different panels so the artist can draw it. You got too many actions in this panel. We need 6 panels per page. We need an action to stop on the 6th panel and start on the first panel on the next page. And he explained all these details out to me, you know, little stuff that the artist needs to help them draw. So I would say the stuff that we're giving to Joe, the script, is extremely detailed. But then at the same time, Joe comes up with like his own concepts, because we might have something in 6 panels in a page written, and he might draw it in 5, and he might have like 1 big panel and 4 little panels, but he completely gets across what we put on the paper.
And then
my thing has always been like to let the artist, especially with the action, choreograph it, because, you know, they can put it down on paper, especially with the action, a lot easier than we can write it. So I kind of like that relationship of like giving them like this great framework, a lot of, you know, detail, but also giving them the liberty to change things up and switch it, because I love seeing what the artist brings to it. It's, you know, it's a cooperation deal.
So who, we've got the writer down. We know the artist. Who's doing the colors?
Anthony is.
Anthony is doing colors.
Look, that would be me. In the Kickstarter video, like when we list me as creator, writer, we list Joe as the artist, and Anthony just says producer. But look, Anthony's just not the publisher. Look, he's the editor, he's the colorer, he's the letterer. Like I say, he's a detail guy, man. He's really the glue that holds this whole thing together. Like I told you, I'm great with coming up with great big concepts and story arcs and stuff like that. But without somebody like Anthony, to coordinate it all and to tighten it all up and focus it. He really helps me focus everything in so that Joe can actually draw it and Joe's not guessing. Like he said, he helps me to provide the framework, you know, or together we provide the framework so that Joe can draw it out and he has the liberty. But, you know, Anthony doesn't like to take as much credit as he should. You know, he wants to call himself the producer, but I mean, he's probably doing about, I mean, what did I name? Just like 4 or 5 jobs on this project?
Sounds about right. And so then, as far as the technical aspect of it, then how important is it to get the colors right? Because, I mean, you can't go bubbly, you know, colorful. You've got to remember that the world you're in. So how important is it to the both of you that the colors, you know, match? I guess match the world, and then Seth, match the vision that you had, or you know, based on the stories that you've been told.
Well, I kind of leave it like this. What I did, you know, in my nonfiction book, I got a bunch of pictures. I probably got 25 pictures that Supreme and the other guys gave me. So, for reference, like for art references, and for color and for style, that's what I did. I gave Joe those pictures, and I gave Anthony those pictures, and I said, look. This is what it needs to look like to a certain extent. I mean, you guys use your own, you know, creativity, you know, but I mean, this is the style that I want. This is the style because this was the era. I'm trying to get it as realistic as we can get because we're pretty accurate to the nonfiction story, but I want to get the art as accurate too. That's why, like Anthony even said earlier, Joe actually went and got some of those photography books from the 80s. You know, like those coffee table books, and he just pours through them, and he looks at all the stuff from the mid-80s New York, and he got this, I know he got one book, but he might have other books that he's using as reference, you know, and even sometimes Anthony stresses all the time, we got to get the backgrounds right, we got to get the graffiti right, we got to get the clothes right, so he stresses that, like he tells me all the time in my writing, he's like, well, what were they wearing? What did they look like? What season is it? What time of day? How much time is elapsing? So I try to get all this information down in the writing so then when it gets to Joe, he has a good framework to do what he's going to do.
As far as my coloring goes, we've set this one in the late fall, so I'm going with a lot of oranges and stuff. I color mostly like more like flat type style. So I guess my biggest reference I've been using is Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee's movie, because I used to be a huge indie movie guy. And it's really hot, really vibrant, very orange. And I'm trying to like adapt that to Joe's style, which is more like superhero. But we're trying to create a mood, trying to make it as accurate as possible. Joe, like I said, he went and found a guy that was a graffiti guy from back in the day to make sure that because I told Joe, I was like, I'd like to see, you know, the graffiti. And he's like, so he found this guy that's actually checking the graffiti to make sure the graffiti is accurate for 1984. the same with the clothes. Cause Joe's, we've talked about it. And it's like in 1984, he doesn't want the guys wearing 1986 clothes.
Sure.
And how many readers honestly are going to know that the members only jacket in this scene is from 1986 and 1989.
But you know, there's going to be that one who's going to call you on it if there's a chronolization. I don't think that's the right word. I think I just made that one up. But if there's a time error such as that, there's going to be that one person who's going to notice that, and you're going to get an angry post on Facebook or something.
And I don't know if I mentioned that I love Mad Men, but one of the things that I love about the show Mad Men is the accuracy of the period, the clothes, the sets, the style. And when I say I want to make a Mad Men comic book, I mean, that's part of it. I want to bring in that kind of like period accuracy and having Joe involved in his wanting to do that as well. I mean, it's the perfect team up.
And correct me if I'm wrong, back to Joe just briefly, but he's kind of more known for another St. Louis area publishing company that I know Stash has worked with, and that's Ink and Drink or Inks and Drinks or one of the two, correct?
Yeah, Ink and Drink.
I can never get that right.
Yeah, the guys at Ink and Drink, they've been at the forefront of the St. Louis indie comic scene for – you know, longer than I've even thought about doing comics. What they do is they do two anthologies a year, and they just choose different topics.
Oh, yeah.
Romance, yeah. Western, war, etc.
I've had Steve Higgins on the show before, so.
Exactly, yeah. So you know what they're about.
Oh, yeah.
And so Joe is a St. Louis comic guy. He was involved in their work. I've submitted stuff to him in the past. They're just like a really great group of guys that are really made the St. Louis comic creating community what it is, and they get all the credit and love for that, for nurturing people like Joe and many, many others.
As we kind of get towards the end here, Supreme Team, they can find it. There is the Kickstarter campaign is currently active?
Yeah, it's currently active. It's listed under Supreme Team. We got a ton of material on there. Look, Anthony and Jordan from Stash, they really put together a real professional package. We got videos. We got the main video on there now with the art and a voiceover about what the book is about and some interviews with me, Anthony, and Joe. And we got descriptions of what the book is. We got all the different tiers. You know, if people pledge and donate different amounts, what they can get. We're giving away different packages, like one package. If you donate a certain amount, you can get a signed copy of the nonfiction Supreme Team book plus a comic. Another tier is for my company that puts out my books, Guerrilla Convict. We have T-shirts on a lot of the gangsters that I write about, and we have a Supreme T-shirt. So that's like one of the offers on the different tiers for the donations. And another thing is I have the original copy. When I first wrote the story about the Supreme Team, probably like around 2006, I wrote it in this street magazine from New York called Don Diva, and I got a limited number of those. So we got that in a package with the comic book. We just tried to provide different little things, you know, as incentives for people to donate money to get, you know, the copy, the issue of the comic, but also other different little things related with the Supreme Team.
And how long does the campaign last? When is it scheduled to end?
At the end of this month, we're going 30 days from the 1st to the like the 31st or the 30th.
All right, so we'll get to you can. I'm sure you can just get it by going to Kickstarter.com and searching Supreme Team. But don't worry, listeners, I'll have the link available on this post on JitteryMonkey.com on this, you know, episode 50 post, so you can access it there. I'll also be sharing it on Facebook, so make sure that if you don't already, get a little like over to facebook.com/nerdsunitedpodcast. Also on Twitter at Nerds United Show. Any other, Anthony? I know that Stash Publishing is always active on Facebook and Twitter. So if you want to plug those, you're more than welcome.
Yeah, sure. Our website is stashpublishing.com. That's STACHE, like mustache, stashpublishing.com. On Twitter, we're at Stash Publishing. And on Facebook, we're at Stash Publishing. And on Twitter, we're at Stash_comics.
And you guys just got a redesign of your logo here in the last week or so.
Yeah, 2015 has been really interesting for us. We focused really hard on the first half of the year of really molding the company into the kind of company we want to be. And we've got a lot of great graphic novels coming up. Supreme Team is the first that we have announced, but the list actually goes on and on, and it's a super exciting time for us.
And Seth, any, you know, where can people, you know, find you on Facebook or Twitter, and anything that or a website that they can go and show their love aside from the Kickstarter?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Seth Ferrante, SethFerranti. My website for my books and all my other true crime and prison type writing is guerrillaconvict.com, GORILLACONVICT.com. And me and Anthony also have this other website. It's a comics entertainment website where we do interviews and profiles with comic creators and artists. We post reviews of music and film stuff and pop culture, and that's called thegrind.com, and that's THEGR1ND.com.
Excellent. I want to thank you guys so much for taking some time out of your busy lives because, well, I don't know this firsthand, but everybody that I talk to who creates a comic says that it's busy. So thank you guys for spending some time with me on episode 50, a milestone episode. And I hope everybody listening enjoyed it. And again, that's Seth Ferranti. That is Anthony Mathenia. Go to Kickstarter.com and search Supreme Team, or go to the website, as I mentioned, click the link. You'll find it on Facebook as well. And throw a few bucks, more if you can, support Supreme Team, because they are looking to get this first special preview issue out, first chapter, if you will, coming up later this year. Do you have a publish date or a release date set on that yet?
I would say December.
December. Just in time for the holidays.
Yeah, and then I want to mention about Supreme Team. This is really the test of a lot of stuff that we want to do. We really want to diversify comics, bring in street lit, urban fiction. So, you know, the success of Supreme Team is really not just for the Supreme Team graphic novel, but also to help get the jump on a lot of other great titles. So if people want to see more diversity in comics, more different kinds of stories, you know, throw us a little money to help us not just make Supreme Team, but also kickstart a whole new genre of comics, we hope.
Because now I'll be the first to say that I love the superheroes, but I also like reading other stuff as well. So if you're like me and you just want to see what else is out there or what could be out there, Stash Publishing is a great start. So check them out as well. Again, you can get to stashpublishing.com, just that simple. We'll have all these links on the post. So again, I want to thank Seth and Anthony for joining me on episode 50 of Nerds United. And that's it. Usually I just wrap it up with a thank you, and then I run out of things to say and back myself, paint myself into a corner. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Seth. Thank you, the listener who tunes in, and maybe you have it subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher or Pod Directory, or maybe you just download it from jitterymonkey.com. Thank you, and we'll see you in episode 51 of Nerds United.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.